other 2 hours. Why, I am Clarence Snyder. Not Clarence S., I'm Clarence Snyder. That's the way I was baptized, and it's on my birth certificate. And I'm sure glad to be here. And I want to first of all thank the committee for inviting me to come here and take part in this wonderful weekend. It's been great so far, as he said before. So far it's been good. I don't know what's coming next, but I've enjoyed it. And I've had an opportunity here to meet a lot of old friends and make a lot of new ones. And I've met people here whom I ran across in the past years in various places. In fact, we have a crew here that came in, flew in here from New Jersey and New York, and Teddy back here has her crowd. Stand up and say hello, Teddy. They almost didn't make it. They had trouble with that plane. They couldn't get the landing gear down, and they had real problem there for a while. But the good Lord was with them, so they're here with us. It's great, as I say, being here. Now, I'm here to talk about rummies and about alcoholism. And I suppose a good way to start is to probably start and talk about how I got here, because I'm kind of a freak in AA, in as much as I came to a fellowship that didn't yet exist. You can figure that one out. Because when I came here, it was not known as Alcoholics Anonymous. This is another one of the fables we have, or myths that we have in AA, that people have an idea this thing started back in 1935, when it actually didn't. The first AA group was actually organized in Cleveland, Ohio in 1939, because up to that time we didn't have this book, AA, and we took the name of the book for our group. Now, how do you like that? I got everyone confused right off the bat. And it's a way to stay, always stay confused. It's easier than thinking things out. Someone mentioned here today, Dave mentioned, that one of the worst things that ever happened in AA is somebody brought these think signs around here. And I'm all in agreement with that. And I can remember when they came, there's some fella down in Miami. He knew someone at the IBM company, and they gave him a whole case of these think signs that they used to distribute around business offices that hang on walls in business offices. And he just got the idea this would be great to have them around AA meetings, so he distributed them widely to every AA group that would accept them. And believe me, that think business is an affront to any full-blooded alcoholic. If you once start thinking around here, you're in trouble. One of the big differences between alcoholics and earth people is this, and they can be distinguished by this difference. So earth people think, and alcoholics feel. We feel. We are emotional people. We are not thinkers. And when we get the idea we're thinkers and start to thinking, we think ourselves into all kinds of trouble. I have watched this development of AA over the years, and I was in the first 40 people that had the opportunity to get into this fellowship. And I'm going to say a little bit more about that later, probably, but I'll tell you how I got here. It's a miracle. I'm going to talk about some miracles tonight, because I think you and I, each one of us, is a miracle. It's a miracle that we're here. It's a miracle we ever had this opportunity. But here we are. Here's what happened to me. I was married to a gal who came from a very clannish family. This family did everything together. And this family used to have a lot of conferences. I was never invited to these conferences for the simple reason I was usually the subject under discussion. These conferences usually... well, along the line of whether I was going to be allowed back in my own home again or I was going out again. I'd been out of that home like a yo-yo. So the last conference comes up, the last chance that I'd have of staying with that August body was predicated upon the idea I should go to work for my wife's brother. Well, work has always been a dirty word to me. And over the years, it hasn't changed much. I'm a salesman, and I live in an abject horror of that someday I might have to go to work. But anyway, my brother-in-law had a truck, and he hauled merchandise from Cleveland to New York and back. I lived in Cleveland at that time. I was born and raised there. And I was to be his helper. He was to teach me to drive this big outfit as a tractor-trailer deal. So he fixed up his sleeper cab so that I was to sleep up in the back of the seat there, up in the little window there, and he would sleep on the seat whenever there would be any sleeping to be done. So I had to say okay to this deal. There's nothing else I could do. So I agreed. I might say that at this point, but this has been many, many years ago, probably 40 years ago, and I haven't had my hands on that wheel yet. So this was a very unsuccessful venture, as I will explain. We start off that night, and it was the beginning of winter. Everything happens to me in lousy weather. Everything happens in the wintertime, it seems. I was born in the wintertime, day after Christmas. That's a lousy time to be born, too. But anyway, we started for New York, and I was an everyday drinker. I was not a periodic. In other words, I was a chronic. I was drunk all the time. And I'd been drunk for several years, and I'd come to the place where I was unemployable. Now, I don't know if you know what unemployable is, but in those days, these were the days of WPA. I want to show you how and tell you how unemployable I was. Some of you folks aren't old enough to know about WPA, but some of your folks have told you about it. But this is a thing that Roosevelt put in to keep their self-respect and keep them eating. They made $18 a week on WPA. And all my jug buddies got on this. Now, you didn't have to particularly do any work, but so long as you can lean on a shovel or something, they'd put you on. And all my jug buddies got on that, and they wouldn't take me. You can imagine, I couldn't even make WPA. I have held a resentment toward Roosevelt ever since then. I tell you another thing. My wife worked. She had to. She better work or no one would be eating. And you know what her job was? I just want you to know how unemployable I was. She was the head of the men's department in an employment bureau, and she couldn't get me a job either. So this is my situation. Well, her brother Bud and I started for New York. We drove all night. We stopped the next morning over in Pennsylvania for breakfast, which I couldn't handle, but he handled it all right. We drove all the next day till the following night. We got to Albany, New York, and he finally conked out. He had a rest. So he pulled the rig over on his side, and he told me he was going to take a nap for a while, and I might do likewise. Well, I couldn't take a nap. I had other ideas. But I told him that here's the capital of New York. I always want to see the Capitol buildings in New York. So I got away from him, and I got down into a place that didn't suit me, and I went down to a place that more suited a man of my estate. And I found an angel in there, and I threw in those drinks in as fast as I could. Then I started back for the truck. I didn't pay for these drinks, incidentally. I went out the back window. And I started down the street, and I started climbing up in my little nest up there, and I stepped on this poor boy's face. And, of course, he knew what was up then, so church was out as far as I was concerned. But he carried me on into New York City, and he dropped his trailer somewhere, and he parked his tractor under that overhead there, where a lot of them leave their outfits. And he kicked me out, and he said, "This is the end of the line, you're no good so-and-so," and he wrote his sister what had happened. So that was the end of my career as a truck driver. I was out before I started. I tell this story for a reason. I needed help. I was 600 miles away from home. It wouldn't have done me any good if I'd been six feet away from home. I wasn't welcome anyway then. But I needed some place to head in. I kind of panicked. And as it happened, he had another sister out there, lived in Yonkers. Well, I figured Virginia would help me, because I'd done her some favors in my palmier days. So I made my way out to Yonkers. And I remember she used to live way up on top of a hill. But I didn't go up on that hill. I went down a hill. I wound up in the Italian section down there. And I met some very interesting people down there. All Italians had Dago Red in those days, and some of them sold it and some of them gave it away. Well, I happened to get in on a free ride. I got slopping that wine around. By the time I got up to Virginia's house, I was probably a sight for sore eyes. I can only remember this trip to Virginia's house, a few things about it. I was rolling around on the floor with her two little girls, the little kids. They're 3 or 4 years old, little babies. And I was drunk, and I was dirty, and I stunk. And Virginia took a dim view of this, so she gathered me up and put me in the back of her car and drove me down to New York, and she kicked me out on the waterfront where her brother had kicked me out. So there I was. Well, I existed in New York City for a long time. But I remember that day that she booted me out and left me there. And I remember the feeling I had. I shall never forget it. Because I was standing on that waterfront, and it occurred to me that there wasn't one person in this entire world who cared one bit whether I was alive or dead. I didn't have a friend left. I didn't have anyone that cared one thing about it. This was an all-gone feeling, but I had to exist, and I did. I'm not going into the story of what I did in New York, but I got along. And I stayed there a long time. But here's what happened. I found out later. Virginia had the doctor for one of the kids sometime later, and they got talking about drinking, which was always a good subject for conversation. And she related the incident of my visit there to her house and rolling around these little kids. And what a nice guy I used to be and what a dirty, stinking, drunken bum I am now. See? So the doctor says, that's odd. He says, I had a brother-in-law who was an awful lush. And he met a strange cult of people, a strange cult. And since he's got into this cult, he spends all of his time chasing around after drunks, trying to fix them. And he says there's a doctor, a medical doctor down in Akron, Ohio, Dr. Robert Smith, who spends all of his time fixing drunks. And he belongs to this cult also. And if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can be directed to Akron and meet this doctor, and maybe this doctor can fix him. Of course, I don't know this is going on, but Virginia passed that news on to Dorothy by letter, I guess. And as everyone does, every rummy, eventually you head for home. You have a homing instinct. I don't know why we go home. We're not welcome, but we go anyway. And I finally made it back to Cleveland. And this was the middle of winter again. And the place where I lived, they used to have snow yet on the ground on 4th of July. I think we were in a snow belt. And this was in the middle of winter. And I remember charging up on the porch, and the snow was up to my elbows out there. And I thought I might talk my way back into the little nest. But I noticed something about the place. The screen doors were still up and the screens were on the windows. And I thought this was odd in the middle of winter. And Dorothy came to the door and she talked to me through this screen door. She didn't let me in. And I pointed out that she needed a man around the house to take care of these type of chores. And she allowed us how she did need a man around the house, but she didn't need one that badly. So I didn't get in. But she did tell me about this Dr. Smith in Akron. And she asked me if I'd want to go down and meet this man. Maybe he could fix me. We used to call it fixing in those days. Fixing drunks. So I had nothing to lose. So she put me in the back of her car. Everybody's riding me around all the time. Yeah. And she took me down to the bus depot. She gave me Doc's name and address. And she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron on the bus. And she sent me on my merry way of adventure. Eventually, my sponsor, Dr. Bob, put me in Akron City Hospital. And I stayed there for a week. And at the end of a week, during this week, these men came in to visit me. And they told me the stories of their drinking life, what had happened to them. These men were all older than I was by 10 or 15 years. I wanted to be like those fellas. They seemed to be having a good time. None of them were sober too long, but they had something I didn't have, and I wanted. And they all talked to me, told me their story. Doc came in every day, late in the afternoon, talked to me. To tell you the truth, I was about half scared of this Doc Smith. He had something on me. And he knew too much about me for some reason or other. Well, anyway, those men talked to me and told me, and as they left, every one of them told me the same thing. They told me they had the answer to my drinking problem, but none of them told me what this answer was. So the last day I'm in the hospital, Doc came in as usual and sat on the foot of my bed, which is, of course, a very unprofessional posture, but he used to do this. And he sat there and always looked at me for a few minutes. This man really used to bug me. And he had big, long fingers, about this long. And a hawk-like nose. And he was a tall, thin fella. He was about 6'4". And I used to look at those fingers of his and think, gee, if he wasn't a doctor, he could make a good pickpocket. But this doctor, I remember the first time I went down, I had to wait for him. I got down to Akron there and went up to the Second National Bank building, and he wasn't in his office yet. And it was warm in there, and I was afraid if I get out on the street, something would happen to me and I wouldn't get back. So I stayed in there where it was warm. But for the want of something to do, I just kept walking up and down in front of his office, and every time I'd pass his office, I'd read on his door, it says, Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, rectal surgeon. I'm going down there to get fixed. It occurred to me this is certainly a new approach to the problem. So I was expecting most anything. Well, anyway, Doc came in and he scared me, of course, and I run out on him the first time. But anyway, after I was in this hospital, I spent this week in the hospital. These men had talked to me, Doc talked to me every day, and the last day he comes in, he looks at me, and he used to call me young fella. When I was in good terms with him, when he was mad at me or I was in for something, he'd call me Clarence. He was a Vermont Yankee. And Doc came in that day, he looked at me, he says, well, young fella, he says, what do you think of all this by now? I said, well, Doc, I think this is great. All these fellas, they don't know me from Adam's hat, but they all come in and tell me the story of their life. But I'm puzzled about one thing. He says, and what's that? I said, every one of those fellas tells me they have the answer to my problem, but they don't tell me what the answer is. What happens now? What are you going to do to me? And what's coming? And what's this answer? How are these fellas sober, and how can I get this way? I shall never forget this. He looked at me. He says, well, we don't know about you, young fella. You're pretty young. I was 35 years old then. You don't have to take your shoes off. I'm sober about 36 years. I'm 71 years old in December. At 35 years old, I was too young. They weren't too sure that I was ready for this. Now, let me tell you how ready I was. I weighed 130 pounds. I'm 5'11". I hadn't worked in several years. I was strictly unemployable. I didn't have a friend in the world. I didn't know where I was going when I left that hospital. I had no place to go. I didn't have 5 cents to finance myself. I had no clothes. All I had was a sweater. It was the middle of winter. That's all I had. And he don't know if I'm ready yet. What do you have to be ready, you know? So apparently I finally convinced him that I was. I guess it got back to that little thing in the 5th chapter. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you know? That's the most important statement in that part of the book. I finally convinced him I was ready. He says, okay, young fella, I'll give you the answer to this. He says, get out of that bed. I says, for what? He says, get down on your knees. I says, well, for what? He says, you're going to pray. I says, who's going to pray? He says, you're going to pray. I said, I don't know anything about praying. He says, well, it's all right. He says, I'll utter a prayer and you can repeat it after me and that'll do for this time. So I balked on this, and he turns around and he says, do you believe in God, young fella? Gee, I didn't expect this from a doctor. I was looking for an operation. This God business I didn't go for because I had gone this mission route when I was in New York. And I just can't stand that deal anymore. I had enough of that. I can't stand going in them today. If you've ever spent much time, I don't suppose any of you folks ever have, But if you have, you know what the bill of fare is in those places. You know, today we have these, what I call second-hand bakeries. You know, all these places bring the baked goods back from the stores and sell it at a retail store. And after they can't sell it, they give it to a mission. And it kicks around a mission a week or two, and if no one eats it, they send it to another one. In the meantime, it collects all this bug juice that they squirt around in these missions, and that's all you can taste. And I can still taste it. And I thought about this, you know. Well, he asked me about this God business, and this shook me up, because medical doctor doing that, and so the only bright answer I could come up with when he asked me that is, well, I says, what does that have to do with it? He says, young fellow, that has everything to do with it. Do you believe in God or don't you? Well, this man wants an answer. So I says, well, I guess I do. He says, there's no guessing about it, you do or you don't. This is a way to give the spiritual foundation of AA to new people. Ease it to you. So I finally had to admit that I did. He says, fine, now we can get someplace. That's when he tumbled me out of bed to the praying, see? Well, I get out of that nice warm bed in that shorty nightgown on that concrete floor on my bones. And he uttered a prayer, and I had to repeat it after him. And I remember this. As we concluded that, he shook hands with me, and he says, young fellow, you're going to be all right. And that night, he carried me to a meeting. It was a meeting of the Oxford Movement. And I shall never forget that entrance to that home. I hadn't been in a home like this for a long time. It was the home of T. Henry Williams, and he was a very wealthy man. He's the head gazebo in the Oxford Movement in Akron, he and his wife. And I went into this home, and I looked around and saw these oriental rugs on the floor, a grand piano over here, a lot of nice pictures hanging on the wall, some expensive bric-a-brac, some little pieces. Those little pieces I took a special note of. And I thought they might possibly come in handy. I would steal a red-hot stove if I had to. And I really had the idea, but I never took anything. It wasn't because I didn't think about it. But anyway, that was my introduction. Another thing that frightened me, that the place was full of women. And I hadn't been around female company, and they scared me. I've gotten over that over the years. I love them, all of them. But this did, it confused me. I couldn't figure out what they're all doing there. These rummies who had visited me, I saw them there, and they come along, give me the glad hand and everything, but I couldn't figure out all these other people. And there's a lot of other men there, too, that were not alcoholics. They were smoking pipes and stuff like that. That's not an alcoholic. An alcoholic don't smoke pipes. You find a freak once in a while that does. But generally, no, they eat these cigarettes. And they got four of them going one time, don't know it. But a pipe smoker to me is a different... He's in a class by himself. A pipe smoker to me denotes a thinker. And I have not met very many alcoholics that you can consider a thinker. I am a salesman, and I walk into some bird's place that's smoking a pipe, and I turn around and leave. I don't even try to sell him, because by the time that guy makes up his mind, I'd starve to death. But he has to figure every little detail out. I tell my kid about this one time, and he pedals cars and does all kinds of stuff. So we're talking about this one time, about pipe smokers. He noticed this, too. He says, but if you want to really get into something, get a pipe smoker that drives a Volkswagen. Try to foul him. Well, anyway, I look at these people, and the alcoholics were in the minority. There were a lot of people there, but most of them were not alcoholics. But it didn't make a difference to me. I attended these meetings for 15 months. I didn't know for a long time what I was attending. I didn't know anything about Oxford Group, never heard of it. And I'd attend these meetings, and they'd an entirely different format than we have now. And they went through a lot of forms and ceremonies that we don't have, thank goodness. But I didn't learn much at meetings. I was quite confused. Most of the things that impressed me, I got after meetings. This is why I feel sorry for a lot of people in AA today. They go to a meeting, and a meeting lasts an hour, and you better, by God, close it up in an hour. or you get in trouble. I've been to a meeting already with a set of alarm clocks. This goes for an hour, and that rings, boom. And I've been to places like this, really. And I used to get a lot of inspiration from these fellas after meetings. They'd get me in a corner and talk to me. I'd go down and visit these fellas on weekends. And I shall never forget one of the greatest things that ever happened to me after one of these meetings. Old Bill Van Horn got a hold of me. Now, we didn't have an AA book. Remember this. There was no book then. There was no literature. There was nobody knew anything about this. We were in the Oxford movement by sufferance and by their good offices and their kindness. That's all. The Oxford group were a bunch of people who were trying to live better lives through the application of spiritual principles. And they thought they could fix anybody, you know. Anyone with problems of any kind that weren't living too well, they could come to the Oxford group and get imbued with this spirit. And all their problems could be solved by turning them over to God. And they had ways of doing this, and they had ways of getting guidance for people and all this sort of thing. They had testimony and witnessing and open confession and all kinds of things in those meetings. And they were getting along fine up to a point. And they were doing very well till they got alcoholics in there. Now, an alcoholic can screw up a two-car funeral, believe me. And I could see after I'm down there a while, there's friction between those people that are not alcoholics and these rummies. And there's trouble. And some of it would break out in meetings sometimes. It was a little embarrassing. But anyway, I learned some things down there. I was inspired some things. One of the greatest things that ever happened to me was one night Bill Van Horn got me in his corner. He always used to do this after meetings. He'd get me, I don't know why, he took a shine to me. This fella, he was a great big fella, tough, rough. And I was about half scared of him because Bill had been a veteran in the First World War, and he had a little pension coming to him. And every time he'd get this pension, he'd go berserk. He'd get drunk, and he used to like to fight policemen. He never knew that he couldn't win because there's too many policemen. And he tried to lick all the policemen in his town and in Akron. And he never succeeded. And they wrapped him around so much that finally his folks got tired of it and they had him committed to the state loony bin. And they threw the key away on him. He was in the Massillon State Hospital. But Doc had gotten him out of that place and put him in a group, and Bill never had a drink there until the day he died. But Bill and I became great friends, and I remember this time he got me in a corner. I'd been going down there for several months. And he said, Clarence, he says, I'm going to give you something here. I want you to read it. I want you to memorize it, and I don't want you to ever forget it. You know, this was the days before they had suggestions. There was no choice in the matter. You give a rummy a choice, you know, always take the wrong one. They misinterpret this easy does it business, you know. Well, anyway, Bill starts going through his billfold. He's standing there by a library table, and he's emptying all this debris on the library table. He's looking for something in particular. Everything there, he's got pictures and clippings and everything there, everything but money. And finally, he comes to what he's looking for. He hands me this slip of paper after he gave me that injunction. So I read this, as he instructed me, ordered me to do. And this was the 2 Corinthians in the 5th chapter, the 17th verse, and it's one of my very favorite verses. It says, therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. How about that? If any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. We have to become new people, entirely new people. A lot of people come to this AA, they get some funny notions that this is some kind of a booze cure or something to sober you up and this stuff. Believe me, kids, it goes way beyond that. Unless we go out way beyond just the idea of getting sobered up, we're not going to stay that way. We have to change. Every person who comes to AA changes. I look out at this wonderful-looking bunch of people here, all dressed up and shined up, and look great, beautiful. But I just wonder what would happen If all of a sudden, tonight, we'd all swill that stuff into us here. You think Las Vegas is an interesting, exciting place? Boy, they'd move this thing to Montana. Every one of us changes. We have to. And let me tell you something else. Every one of us, not only is a different person, but we have to stay that way. We have to improve. There's no static condition. Well, here's the way I started. Anyway, I was in this Oxford movement, and I attended these meetings for 15 months. Now, I'm going to give you a little AA history that you don't read from approved literature. You might have guessed by now I'm something of a maverick. I can disagree, and I can be damn disagreeable with it. Well, anyway, this thing is going on, and finally, I was told by my sponsor and the others that I'd have to spend the rest of my life fixing drunks because I had a talent for it. Being an alcoholic myself, I had a talent for it. And I was obliged to do this as an avocation. Get that? And this was supposed to be the most important thing in my life because everything in my life depended upon what happened to me as far as my sobriety was concerned. So I took them at their word. And at that point, I was coming down to Akron from Cleveland all the time, attending meetings. And I became the first and foremost bar stool snatcher in history. I went every place there were rummies. And I'd talk to them. I'd try to influence them. I'd sit with them. I'd lay down with them. Anything to talk to rummies. And I didn't get any place. It took me 7 long months. And I had thousands of rummies to work on, and these, I want you to remember, in those days, these were all unspoiled rummies, too. They hadn't been up and down the line like we get them today. They're ruined before we get them, some of them. But these fellows were all fresh, 24 carats. And I couldn't do a thing with them. I was trying to carry the message. And I spent a lot of time, and I got a lot of heartaches over this. I wanted to be like those other fellas in Akron. I thought I had to prove myself, and the only way I could really be one of those Indians would be that I would get a man in that hospital, in City Hospital, and sponsor him. So it took me 7 long months of continuous effort and disappointments, and heartrending, I mean this too, till I finally got my first guy. When I got the first one in there, I know why now, because I didn't have a message to carry. Today, there's guys come in, it's AA, and they're in here for 6 weeks, and they're running around sponsoring 9 people. They're carrying the message. They're carrying the message they don't have. No wonder we get screwed up. No wonder we have all these... She read something here today. I've never heard that. Don't you believe it? I never heard that thing that you read. This is something new to me. I'm learning things. But anyway, I suppose it's an institution some places, but I really have never heard that. And I go to meetings 2 or 3 times a week. It's funny, isn't it? I'm missing something. Well, anyway, it wasn't long till we had about a dozen men going to Akron to meetings every Wednesday night with me. Now, here's where the big thing came. Here's where AA started. Now, listen to this carefully. We were going to this Oxford movement, and I could see some frictions coming up in the Oxford, but this wasn't what determined a split from there. Here's what determined the split. Here's why we broke away from the Oxford movement in Cleveland. The Oxford movement was a group of people who were all trying to live good lives, and they were all Protestants. There were no Catholics in it. A Catholic could not belong to the Oxford group. Not that the Oxford group would keep them out, but their church would keep them out at that time. I don't know if the Catholic Church has changed that idea. Now they might have. They changed a lot of them, but at that time, this is the way it was. On account of this reading the King James Version of the Bible in the meetings and getting guidance for other people and a lot of other things that they objected to, and this open confession and all that sort of thing. So here I told all these men that this would not interfere in any way with their religion, if they had any. So we go down there, and those Irishmen, they sit there and they see this fellow reading out of this King James Version. They see these people witnessing and and all this open confession and people getting guidance for other people and all this sort of thing, and they look at this performance, they look at each other, and then look at me. And I get static all the way back to Cleveland. And it's trouble. And they can't abide it. They can't go along with it. So the only thing I can do is go down and talk to my sponsor. I'm 15 months sober by that time. So now I'm a veteran of 15 months, of course. You know, this gives me the privilege to argue with my sponsor and tell him how to run his business. So I went down to see Doc about it, and I told him what our problem was. And he says, see, they didn't have any Catholics in their group down there. They only had one. They had Phil Smith, and he was a fallen away Catholic, which means he was probably pretty well screwed up anyway. And by the time he got through listening to people who were in Christian Science and Unity and the Baptist Church and the Methodist and all and the rest of this thing, why, they were more screwed up. He was more screwed up than ever. The guy didn't have a chance. He finally died drunk. But here we had seven out of these 12 fellas who were on that side of the fence. So I told Doc what this was, and he says, well, we're not keeping them out. They can come. I said, yeah, they can come, but the church keeps them out. He says, well, that's tough. There's nothing we can do about that. I said, oh, yes, there's something we can do about that. I says, we have a book now. We had written this book in the fall of 1938, and it was published early in 39. It came out. Now, someone asked me to say something about this book. So I hear some of the weirdest deals about this book. Like somebody wrote this stuff right out. That's a lot of hogwash. It's a miracle this book was ever written. Because I'll tell you why. You take any three or four alcoholics in this room and try to get them to agree on any one thing and you're out of order. Well, there was about 40 of us that were working on this book. 40 guys. A few of them were in New York. Some of them were Akron. I'm in Cleveland. And this is all going on by mail, if you please. We couldn't get there and tear each other's hair out. We had to do this by mail. Bill and Hank Parkhurst would send some stuff down they had written for the book, and we'd blue pencil it and red pencil it and screw it up and add something to it and send it back. And they'd return it to us, and this went back and forth through the mail. Can you imagine getting 40 of these nuts from one end of the country to the other to agree on this thing? It's a miracle. But it came out, and it needs no changing. Isn't that something? Most miraculous thing that's happened. So that's how the book came about. There was not 100 guys in it. When we tried to get a name for this book, a lot of names were proposed, and the name 100 Men came up. And then we got counting noses, and we were a long way from 100 men. A lot of other names, but this name, Alcoholics Anonymous, sounded kind of mysterious, and there wasn't any other books of that name. So that was our name. So here's why I'm having this argument with Doc, and we got pretty heated about it. And he says, you can't do that. We have to stay with the Oxford group. We owe these people our lives. I says, that's very true. I owe them my life, too. But what about these other fellas that can't come? He says, well, they just have to do the best they can. I said, no, we don't need that. All we need is the 12 steps and the four absolutes, and we have a program that anyone can accept and work with. It gives us a universality so that a person can come in whether he belongs to any church or not. You don't even have to believe in a church. They can come. He says, you can't do it. He says, well, we're going to do it. As it happened, we had a fella, another guy, another Irishman, I had in a hospital at the time. He was in there at the same time Raleigh Hemsley was in, the ball player. And I went out to see his wife. His wife's name was Grace. And I talked to her about using her home for a meeting place. She had a big home. They were losing it, but they still had it. And she was tickled to death to use it for a meeting hall. So I went down to Akron the following Wednesday night. I made the announcement down there. Now, here's the first big riot we ever had. Made the announcement that we are no longer, the Cleveland contingent isn't coming down here as a group any longer. We're going to start our own group in Cleveland, Ohio, at 2345 Stillman Road next Thursday night. And it's not going to be an Oxford group. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book. And only alcoholics and their families are welcome. Nobody else. Boy, the roof went right off the house. Clarence, you can't do this. It's done. We'll come down. We must talk about this. There's nothing to talk about. So we had an awful time. You see, AA was born in a riot, and it grows in riots. But if I thought that was a riot Wednesday night in Akron, you should have seen next Thursday in Cleveland. Boy, they all came up. They had a week to talk about this. And they crashed our meeting there and tried to break it up. And one guy was going to lick me. And a lot of people got in between us and saved my skin. But we stood our ground. And that's how AA started. That was the first group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it started in May of 1939. So that ought to clear up a lot of things in some people's minds. It's a little confusion anyway. That's the way AA started. I say we start in a riot and we grow in riots. Did you ever hear of a group just starting because we need another group? Did you ever hear this? Let me know if you do. Because here's the way they usually do. Some bird's up here running this group and doing a good job. He's taking care of things, and the group is getting along pretty well. So finally, this guy here, he gets jealous, or he thinks, what in the heck is that bird doing? He says, I could run a better group in my sleep. So he talks to a couple of his chums, and they agree with him. First thing you know, they're choosing up sides, and they'll be at each other with ball bats pretty soon. But they have a split, see? So he takes his group and moves out, see? And he says, watch them all get drunk without us. So the guys that stay back there, they say, watch that bunch, good riddance. They'll all be drunk in no time. The fact remains, this bunch does fine here without this one, and this one does fine without them. This is the way we go. And why is that? Well, there has to be people who are leaders. They have to run in front of the pack. And they talked, some ignoramus brought something in AA that they call unity. You see this crap around unity? Did you read about unity in AA? They have big signs hanging around in some of the groups. Unity. This is unity. This is unity. Believe me, if we had unity, as these people are talking about, we'd have one great big group. There'd be three people doing the work, and the rest of them all out getting drunk. That's unity. No wonder some people hate me. I am not in a popularity contest, but I have great faith in things in AA, and I have great convictions about things. And believe me, after the thousands of rummies whom I've been privileged to meet and work with in one way or another over these years, I'm almost 36 years in this thing. I will be in February. I met a lot of rummies. I probably know more rummies than anybody in the world. I really do. No kidding. And I worked with a lot of them. I've had opportunities a lot of people never had to work with them. Because I was in before, during the pioneering days. And I learned a lot of things the hard way. But I'll tell you one thing, sure. If a person believes in this program and believes in what it stands for, and he takes this program and applies it to his life, lots of things are going to happen to you that you're incapable of doing yourself. I look back on my experience in AA years ago, at the beginning of AA. Now, as you might have guessed from what I told you about Cleveland, I happen to have organized the first Alcoholics Anonymous group that ever started, as I just related. And eventually, they had to move out of the Oxford group in Akron, and they got thrown out in New York. They got thrown out of there. I'll tell you how this happened. And it happened about the time we started in Cleveland. They didn't have much success with rummies there because they were getting a poor quality of a rummy, I guess. And they didn't have too many of them, but they were meeting at Calvary House in New York. And the people in the Oxford group got awful sick of these rummies putting the arm on them and picking their pockets and one thing or another. And they weren't getting anywhere with these rummies. They were a disturbing influence. So the Oxford group in New York finally made this classic statement. And this, they said they wanted no more to do with alcoholics, dipsomaniacs, drug addicts, or pickpockets. So that took care of them. And that's when they had to move out and make a group of their own in New York. But by this time, we were going helter-skelter over there in Ohio. Now, this is the beginning of AA. And it went on and on and on. It's going to go on and on. But this is a program that's foolproof. if we will but use it. But a lot of people, they get so screwed up, or they try to screw this program up, and they have all kinds of connotations they put on it. And all we got, really, the whole program here, you can go ahead and read all these things you want. But when we get right down to basics, our program is the 12 steps, and that's it. And I'll tell you, I'd like to go over them. I'm not going to give you a full treatment on this, but I'm going to go enough so that people can get an idea on just what this program means. Because I hear some of the dippiest things about this program. Like some guy will come and say, "Well, when should I take these steps?" No. Say, "Well, when do you want to get well?" Well, I hear other people say, he says, "I want to get well now." Well, we take them now. Okay? Then I hear people say, "Well, if you don't like this step, forget it. You just take what you want out of this and throw the rest out the window." Well, you better go out the window with it, sir. Because every one of these steps has a purpose and a meaning, and it does something for us. And this idea of taking it as you please, this is a lot of hogwash, and I'll just tell you this. We all admit, I believe, we're pretty much in agreement anyway on this one thing. Pretty much in agreement, honestly. We never are unanimous in anything. But most people will go along with the idea that this is an illness. And, well, suppose you're real sick. You're real sick. You're real ill or something. And you go to the doctor and he looks you over and takes x-rays and gives you all these examinations and he's, you know. He said, ooh. Now, doctors do. So he writes out a prescription for you, and it has 12 ingredients in it. And you've had a little education, and you can know, you learn something about Latin someplace, and you can make out some of this hen-scratching the doctors put on these prescriptions. And you look at those 12 things, and you go to the drugstore, and you're looking at that thing, and you think, gee, that one ingredient, I don't like that. That's sour stuff, and I don't like that. And looks down here in this other ingredient. Oh, I don't like that stuff. It makes me itch every time I take any of that stuff. This other stuff down here makes me belch. I don't like it. I don't like the belch. And the other thing makes me short of breath or something. So you got 4 things out of these 12 ingredients you don't like. You don't want to do it. So you take your prescription to the drugstore down here, and they say, "Mr. Druggist, here's my prescription. Will you fill it for me? But don't put in this stuff here because it makes me belch. Don't put in this stuff here because it gives me the itch." And on, see? So do you think you're going to get well? You're critically ill. And the doctor gives you these things, and there's, every one of those ingredients is very important to bringing you, to preserving your life. And you go and tell that druggist to leave part of it out. You might as well not go. This AA program of 12 steps is a prescription for health and for living and for life here and hereafter, believe me. Let's talk about these 12 steps. You may not... People discuss these steps, and sometimes I wonder what's going on. I go to some of these step meetings sometimes, and I listen to some of this stuff, and I wonder, I'm missing something or something. But here, let me give you my idea of what these steps are, and keep in mind this one thing. I was here when they were written. I know what they're supposed to do for us, so don't give me any fuss about it. Our program is divided in 4 phases. We have to have a beginning. And the first phase is our phase of admittance. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Okay, that's admittance. There's a need for a change. We have something that has to be changed. There's a definite need there, and we admit it, that we're powerless over alcohol. If we are really an alcoholic and are ready to quit, a lot of alcoholics aren't. But I refer back to that 5th chapter that we just heard read a while ago so well. And to that sentence, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are now ready to take certain steps. Did you notice it says to any lengths? No idea of dodging anything. Alcoholics are extremists by nature. Let me say this word about an alcoholic. They're different than other people. There's a lot of people, no matter how hard they try, they can never become alcoholic. Really. They just don't have it. This is a privilege that's reserved for a chosen few. A lot of people can drink and use booze for what it's intended, but there are some people, nix. And that's us. We can't handle it. It's not for us. And the alcoholic has certain definite characteristics, and you can spot one of them. You don't have to ask a guy. You don't even have to smell him. You can tell an alcoholic when you meet him. You don't believe this? I'll tell you a few things about that in a moment. But the alcoholic's characteristics, I don't say that earth people don't have some of these, but the alcoholic has them all. Every alcoholic has. I've never met an alcoholic worthy of the name who was not a high-strung individual. I've never met one who was not a sensitive soul. He's always going around looking for someone to hurt his feelings. He has a wealth of imagination. Terrific imagination. He's the biggest liar that ever wore shoes. He will lie when the truth will serve him better. He lies for practice. He'll never admit anything. Never. This is where he has trouble. It's one of our steps. He is a very social fellow. He needs love. He has some awful hang-ups. He had every one of them. I've only met one in my experience who did not have a terrific inferiority complex, feelings of inadequacy. He carries great feelings of guilt. Sometimes he thinks he's a good boy after he gets an AA. Well, the trouble is, it's his conscience. Conscience takes care of an awful lot of things that should go under the heading of cold feet. But he does have a conscience, and these things hurt him, and alcoholics live in guilt for a long time. They need a complete catharsis and cleaning out in these departments, really. So the alcoholic is he's a social person. He needs company. He's lonesome, lonely. He'll be in a crowd of 1,000 people and he'll be lonely. Our loneliness is dispelled. I don't care where you go, what town you go into, you walk into an AA meeting, and you're at home. You inherit a whole bunch of friends, ready-made friends right there. Our social life is entirely different than any other that I can think of. We don't stand on any ceremony. We don't take references from people to get membership here. You have already established your right to be here when you come. So we meet differently and we have a rapport with people. We don't have to explain that we're alcoholics. I've had this thing happen to me many times. People are nice to me. They're good to me. A lot of them are, except some. And they will invite me to come to places such as this. I go to a good many places, to conferences and retreats and what have you around the country. And they'll meet me at the airport. These guys don't know me. I remember one time I went up to Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. You ever hear of Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan? Well, that's the end of the world. And I know nobody up there, no one. They don't know me. They've heard a tape or something, you know. So they invite me up. These things always happen on Friday night when everyone's going home. All the salesmen and all the peddlers and all the fellas have been away all week. They go home on Friday night. And the families are generally there waiting to see what condition Joe is when he falls off that plane. And there's always a crowd in the airport. And I get off that airplane, and I walk up there, and the first thing you know, I hear him say, there he is. Why? They recognize me. You walk down the street, and a panhandler will come along, and he'll pass 5 or 6 people to hit you, put the arm on you. Why? He feels you. There's something about you and he that there's an attraction there. And this has happened to me so many times. I remember one time I was going to Kansas City. I was on a plane and we changed planes in St. Louis. My wife says, "Say, who do you know in Kansas City?" I said, "I don't know anyone." says, well, how are they going to know you? There'll be thousands of people in that airport. I said, I'm going to wear a rose in my hair. She says, you're nuts. I know. I'm sure of that. I says, we're all nuts. And that's another thing I want to also commend you all for being. You're all nuts. And if you're not nuts, you don't belong here. This is the greatest collection of nuts in any society. We all have to be that way. If we're sane and sensible, I've never seen anybody that ever got completely sane in AA. We get around, have a good time, and we're able to make a living, and we have a lot of fun. But this sanity bit, I can see where some of them back up on that second step. But we are. We're the greatest collection of nuts in the world. That's just a little aside. But here we come along and we admit we're powerless over alcohol, that our life is unmanageable. That admitting business is something new for us, too. And we don't hurt real badly. We're not going to admit that. We're going to hold some reservations so we never get started. Step two, it says we start in our second phase. Second phase is submission. We have admission, now we go into submission. It says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Sanity. And some of the brethren back up on that sanity deal. And believe me, if it's just a little reflection, we can easily be convinced. Especially these periodics. There's two types of rummies. There's a periodic and there's a chronic. I'm a chronic. I'm drunk all the time, so people know what to expect of me. I'm consistent. But these periodics, these are the guys that ought to be, they ought to abolish them. They are a curse. What happens to a periodic? This guy gets a good job. He's advancing in business. He makes a lot of nice friends, joins some nice clubs. He gets a good wife and a nice family, a nice car, a nice home, nice furniture, and a bank account and some jingle in the pocket. And everything is going great. And all of a sudden, blue, he gets drunk and blows the whole thing. See? Well, it's a shambles. He loses the cars, he loses the home, he loses the wife, he loses the family, he loses the furniture, he loses the bank account, he loses everything, period. What happens to this guy? Next thing you know, he gets another job. And the heck of it is, he usually gets a better one than the other one. And he starts again. He builds up the same thing. He gets a new home, a new wife, a new family, a new car, a new furniture, and the whole thing starts. He builds this up again, see? And the next thing you know, he's joined some of these fancy clubs, and he's doing great. And then what? Boom. The repetition. This goes on all his life. And then you tell this guy he's nuts, and he takes a poke at you. What do you call that kind of insanity? I'm sure glad that people told me that I was nuts and excused me for a lot of things that I needed excusing for. All right. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Why did I come to believe this? To me, I came to believe it through the power of example of those men who preceded me. They told me their stories. I wanted what they had. I wanted to be one of them. So I was going to do anything they told me to do that was in my power. So the power of example. I couldn't run my life, and they told me this power had helped them and it would help me. So since I wanted to get well, I was willing to do that. I was ready to quit. I'd come to that point, I'd do anything. Okay, here's the next step. Here's the one that tells us and determines whether we are in AA or we are going to be around AA. Get that difference. And this is what happens. Here's the first big reservation. Third step, it says that we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. Boy, that's some decision to make. And believe me, if we don't hurt a whole lot, we're not going to make that decision. We're going to hold reservations on that one. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to this ethereal creature in the blue yonder, of whom I know very little about and probably scared to death of. This is ridiculous. I can't do that. If I hurt badly enough, I'll do it. And there's the crux of the whole matter. An alcoholic will never do anything till he hurts badly enough. An alcoholic cannot recover through intellectual acrobatics. It has to be something else. That's all been tried over the years. Alcoholism is the oldest malady on record. You read about alcoholism in the Bible. And the 10th step mixed up. They have no connection at all with each other. And the exact nature of our wrongs doesn't mean we have to stand here and tell every incident that ever happened, every dirty little stinking thing that we indulged in. I'd be in a bad shape if I had to do that, because I can't remember all these things that I did. I operated so long in blackouts. And a lot of the most interesting things that happened to me, other people have told me about. And some of them are a matter of record. But I don't have conscious recall at all of these things. And I must have been pretty busy at times, from what people tell me. So here's someone at my elbow here helping me with this step. I try to get out of it, and he can nudge me and suggest that I did this and that and the other thing, and I was a liar, I was a thief, I was this and that and the other thing. And I have to admit, because he helps me do this by outlining what he did, and I go along with it. I don't have to be there all by myself. Step six says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. How about that? Doesn't say we're kind of ready or about to be ready. We're entirely. An alcoholic is entirely in everything he does. He's an extremist in everything he does. He works hard, he plays hard, and when he gets drunk, he makes a career out of it. There's no halfway measures with a rummy. So the trouble is, some people think when they come in AA, and they think that they can do this on a halfway measure. That's their thinking. It's like this blubber up here. They're trying to tell you they're thinking. They got nothing to think with when they come here. They feel. Well, anyway, we're entirely ready to have God remove them. We can't remove them. So we're getting right down to business there. So then we humbly asked him to remove all these defects of character. Defects of character. We want him to remove these things, and we ask him to. The good book says anything we ask, believing, we shall receive. You believe that? You've done that step. You'll get along with it all right. We've now finished the second phase. We had admission and submission. Now we're going to enter restitution. If we're going into a new life, we have to clean up the garbage from the old so we don't carry it into the new. The good book tells us about you don't put new wine in old bottles. They burst. The bottles they had then were skins. So it's a good simile. Well, anyway, we start on this third phase. It says we made a list of all persons we had harmed. Important there, and became willing to make amends to them all. Get that? Now, there's a lot of people, there are a few people, I should say, in my experience, I didn't want to make amends to. In fact, I didn't even want to see them. I don't think they cared much about seeing me either. And this was a painful thing to do. But it says the next step, we made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I think those two steps should be taken with the help of a sponsor. I don't think we should try to make the restitution part of our program without help of an experienced person who is wise in these things. Because we can louse up some other people we have no business lousing up. But here it is. We make the list. We are willing to make amends to anyone. And I'm glad I made my amends. The people I had to make amends to, they're dead and gone now. I'm glad I had that opportunity. Some people we can't make amends to. We don't even know them. So we have to leave that to God. He'll take care of that if we're sincere. All right, we've gone through three phases of our program. We've taken nine steps. Now get this. We've got one more phase to go through. After we have taken these nine steps, we've gone through admission, submission, and restitution. We've taken nine steps. Not just looked at them, we've taken them with the help of a sponsor. All right, now listen very carefully, because the first time I ever said this, I started a riot that has never subsided. And, boy, this is something. After you've taken the nine, forget them. You don't have to bother with them anymore. We have a very simple program. You can live on the last three, but first we must take those nine. Now, you never have to use those nine again, except in two instances. If you resign and resume, we have to go all over it again. course, we have to know something about them if we're trying to explain them to someone like I'm trying to do now. But as far as our own use, God help you, you should never have to do it again. So we don't have to worry about 12 steps anymore. We have 3 steps to be concerned with the rest of our lives. And these are our steps of construction. Admission, submission, restitution, construction. Here's where we construct our life and we build a life. We live on the last 3 steps. Listen carefully to these steps. Listen to this 10th step and see the difference in this step and in the 4th step. It says we continue to take personal inventory, not moral inventory. We've taken care of that moral business way back there. And God has helped us with that and taken these things from us. So that's done. But this personal inventory, we continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Now that's a switch for a rummy. He never admits anything. He'll never admit it's cold outside. It might involve him in something. If you think he admits anything, try this sometime. Go down to court someday. I don't suppose any of you ever been there. But people don't take time to find these things out. There's things going on down in your courthouse you should know about because you're paying these people. It's costing you money in taxes. You ought to know what they're doing with your tax money. So you go down there, especially on a Monday morning. This is a good time to go because all the drunks are up before the judge on Monday morning. And this drunk has been out on the weekend, and he has gotten drunk. He took his car, and he sideswiped a couple of automobiles. He ran over somebody, went to a storefront, and ends up fighting a policeman. And he lands in a slammer. So he gets up there in front of this judge in the morning. The bailiff reads the charges off. The judge says, "You are drunk." "No, not me." "Well, you were drinking." After a lot of wheeling, he'll break down and he'll admit to having a couple of beers. I've never heard of anyone getting in trouble drinking whiskey. But these guys that drink a couple of beers are a disaster. Stay away from it. They won't admit anything. All right. We're admitting things here. When we're wrong, we're admitting it. Just think what that does for us. We've been on the defensive all our life. Finally, we get us in a corner after we're getting well here, and here's a way to get rid of things. When you're all wrong, admit it, forget it, don't fight it. It sounds hard to do, but really it's easy, and it's a great relief once we do that. It's great, it's simple. And here's the meaning of that 10th step. No alcoholic I have ever known gets drunk because of anything big happening to him. Really, I have seen tremendous things and awful tragedies happen in alcoholics' families. They don't get drunk over this. You know what makes them drunk? Little things. And a conglomeration of little things. Neglect. The sins of omission instead of commission. This is what gets to us. Selfishness. Take these alcoholics to stay around here a while and get the benefit of this, and they wind up drunk. Figure out why. There's always a reason. People say that's excuses, that's horse feathers. There are reasons why they get drunk. And there's no fella or gal in this group that gets drunk that I can't find out in less than 5 minutes why he got drunk and put my finger right on it if he's had any real benefit of this. It's very simple. Usually it's selfishness and neglect. All right, this 10th step is talking about this inventory. Here's how I work mine. Every day I'm out among people, as you are. We all have to deal with people. And I'm a salesman, as I mentioned before. And I've always felt that they ought to have a day set aside every year for salesmen when they can shoot people with impunity. Really? But you're not allowed yet to. They haven't passed any law on that line yet. But anyway, every day I'm out dealing with a lot of people. At night I'm in bed. Here's the way I handle my 10th step. The day is over with, and I think about where I've been today, what I've done, who I've seen, and what's transpired. It's amazing how many things we do in the days, during the 24 hours, really. Amazing what things we get into. Sometimes I think about my day and I'm not too proud of some of the things I've done today. And believe me, I don't waste any time trying to straighten that up. If I owe somebody an apology, I'm going to get right to it. I cannot afford to let these little things climb up and pile up on my back to a place I can't carry them anymore. I have to dispose of them as I go along. And this is a little secret in AA. And if you will consider this and do as I've done with it, you'll get along. Because I don't want any complicated program. I'm not a complicated guy. I don't have sense enough to handle a complicated program. I have to have something simple but effective. And this program is very simple if we'll let it be this simple. So I'll take care of things as they go along. They won't pile up on me. And I keep a good attitude this way. I don't have any feelings of guilt about anything. I don't have to duck anyone. There isn't a person I deal with today or yesterday or last year that I can't meet on the street as a friend. I'm not afraid of them. I used to hide from people. People used to hide from me too. But this isn't that way anymore. I don't allow it to be. So I don't complicate my life trying to carry a lot of things, a lot of garbage I don't need. Okay, that's the 10th step. It has nothing to do with that moral inventory. This is my personal life, day to day, a day at a time. I hear people talking about a day at a time. This is what a day at a time means. You're not staying sober a day at a time. You're living a day at a time. This is a living program. Let's quit that sober business. After you're around here a while and get a little bit of walking around sense, we are having a living program a day at a time, and this is a way to keep it that way so that yesterday's transgressions and the day before doesn't pile up on us. Let's live today and take care of the day's activities and responsibilities. 11th step, listen to this step. It's tremendous. A lot of words in this step, but this is a step that leads us into a prayer life, which so many of us need so desperately. It says we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Let's break that step down and see just what it means. We're seeking something, and we're seeking it through prayer and meditation. What is prayer and what is meditation? A lot of people have never considered this. To me, prayer is talking to God, this person I turned my will and life over to back in the third step. I'm talking to Him. And meditation is when I'm listening to Him. Did it ever occur to you that the good Lord gave you two ears and one mouth? There must be a reason. Now, all of us will pray for something, but we won't sit around long enough to listen. See, we don't get the answers, so we say, I never answered my prayers. Every prayer is answered. Sometimes it's wait, sometimes it's maybe, sometimes it's no. Sometimes it's yes. I have found out in my years in this fellowship that I don't get all of my wants, but I sure as the devil get all of my needs. I do. And that's important to me. And don't ever think you're going to get all your wants, because you won't. But you get all your needs from a loving Father. He'll give them to you, whatever you need. If you don't believe it, just look at this crowd here. They all needed something very badly, and you have it here. It's up to you and I to take care of it and use it. All right, we're seeking through talking to Him and listening to Him. What are we seeking? We're seeking to establish a conscious contact with God. Just what does that mean? Well, it means that I can feel that He's as close to me as this boy here. I can feel Him. I can talk to Him. I can get answers from Him. He's right here. He's way out there in the blue yonder and inaccessible. He's right with me. He's all around me. And I can communicate with Him. I can ask Him, and He can tell me. See, I turned my will and my life over in the third step. Now I have to ask for my orders. God, what do you want me to do? It tells me what I'm praying for. A lot of people get up and they pray for sobriety. That's a big bunch of hogwash. Don't do that. You have sobriety. Thank Him for it. But it says we're praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. God, I turned my will and my life over to you. What do you want? I'm your boy. What do you want me to do? Give me my orders. And then I listen for the orders. That's what this step means. It's very simple. Later on, we'll learn how to pray for other things. First, we'll learn how to pray for other people. And eventually we'll pray for other things. You can pray for that Cadillac later on. But until we get ourselves oriented in this way of life, this is the way we start. It's very simple. But we complicate things so. We sure do. And there's 200 well-chosen words here that if we put our attention to it, we can't go wrong. All right, we're getting down here. The good book says that he's never going to put anything on us that he won't give us the power to execute, you know? So we're asking him what he wants us to do and give us the strength and power to do it. That's just simple. That's all we have to do. Isn't that a simple way to live? Very simple. Nothing complicated. Then we go down to the 12th step. Here's a dandy. Listen to this very carefully because it tells us something. People say to me, when should I go out and do 12-step work? Gee, this is something. What does it say in the 12th step? It says, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. How simple can it be? When am I supposed to go out and do 12-step work? You don't do that till you have a message to carry. That's why it took me 7 long months to get my first baby. And I talked to thousands of rummies before I got that first one. Why? Because I was trying to carry a message I didn't have. It's as simple as it is. We shouldn't be out there sending a boy out to do a man's job. We should be prepared when we go out on a 12-step call. You know why? You are the only person who can do this job. There's been a lot of things tried down through the centuries, but you have the possibility of helping this person. Saving his life, saving his sanity, and probably even his soul. You should be prepared and know that when you go. So you should have gone through these steps, and then you're entitled to go out and carry a message, because you'll have a message then, see? It's simple, very simple. Just having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, now who are we carrying this message to? I shudder sometimes in this new age of ours. People are trying to get back and make an Oxford group out of this again. They're trying, they're running around, and they want to get this and that and the other thing in our fellowship. Remember this. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's very plain. It says that in the step. This is not Fatso Anonymous. This is not Gamblers Anonymous. This is not Heroin Anonymous. This is not Nose Pickers Anonymous. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. You and I are privileged and are singularly suited to help alcoholics. If all these other people want to... you hear people say, well, everybody ought to be in this. They ought to have this program. It's great. I agree. But let them start their own program. Don't come in here and louse up ours. We can louse it up enough. Everything that we have in this program, let me tell you where this program came from. A lot of people don't know this. Everything in our 12-step program is designed to change our life. This is a life-changing program. And if you don't think the lives are changed, take a look at this crowd in here. We're all changed. Every person changes the first day he walks through those doors. He'll stay sober. Why does a person walk in here, he's been drunk for 10 or 20 years, and he walks into an AA group and bingo, no more drinking. He's through drinking. Why? Why does he stay sober here and he never couldn't do it going to all the hospitals and sanitariums and Cooney Roos and what have you? Why? Something happens to you. You're given a chance. You are touched with something here and you're given a free ride. What you do with that ride is important. Did you ever stop to consider how fortunate you and I are? Let me tell you something. Down through the ages, as I started mentioning when I first started this dissertation a couple hours ago, everything's been tried. People have put people in jail, they put them in loony bins, they've cussed them, they've discussed them, they've promised them something, they've beat them, they've done everything to overcome this thing of alcoholism. Nothing ever worked. Until just a few years ago, We were blessed with getting this wonderful program that you and I are privileged to be in tonight. Did you ever stop to consider that there are millions and millions and millions of people who have staggered across the face of this earth that never had this opportunity that you and I have? They lived, or they survived, they died alcoholics, and probably died in disgrace and took some of the members of their families and friends down with them. They never had this opportunity you and I have. As I mentioned, alcoholism is an old, old malady. You know, I've mentioned before that you read about it in the Bible. I'd like to tell you some stories from the Bible. Would you like to hear a few examples? You're not going anyplace, are you? All right, the first reference to alcoholism and alcoholics is in the very first book of the Bible, in Genesis. You want to read about a rummy? Read the story of Noah and the ark. There's a guy that tied one on. What did that guy do the first thing that he found out they were coming to land? What did he do when they get land? He made some wine and got drunk. He made a real jackass out of himself on that ark. Read that story. Probably a lot of you have. Now, nobody but a rummy would ever done what he did in the first place. Two of this and two of that and put them in a big boat. Normal people don't act like that. A great rummy story that I love is the story of the Jericho Road, the Good Samaritan. Here's a rummy story. Now I'll prove it to you. Everybody in this story is involved. Here's this fellow. He's all beat up. He's stripped of his clothes. And he's lying out there in the middle of the road, all beat up and bleeding and half dead. Along comes a priest, and he sees him lying there, and he knows what it is. He's just a dirty, stinking, drunken bum. Good enough for him to get beat up. He gets drunk, let him get beat up. He deserves it. So he passes over on the other side of the street. He's not going to get involved. Along comes this other chap. He sees him. Same thing. He crosses the street. He don't want any part of this bird. He knows he's just a drunken bum. Let him lay there. Good enough for him. That's been the attitude towards alcoholics for a long, long time. Along comes a Samaritan. Now, the Samaritans were not the chosen people at the time. They were not the upper crust of society. But this guy comes along, and he's a traveling salesman. Yeah, he is. I'll prove it to you. He's a salesman. And he's doing that territory. He's doing that territory. And he's likewise, he's a rummy. And here's what he did. Now, let's just prove everything I said. He gets down off of his form of conveyance, which is certainly not a Chevrolet. It's probably a mule. And what did he do with this guy? It says he ministered to him, and what did he give him? He gave him a drink. Read the story. He'll tell you. And he cleaned up this fellow a little bit and ministered to him. And he put him on his form of conveyance, and he took him to an inn, a motel. And what did he do? Here's how I know he's a rummy. I know they're all involved in this. He says to this innkeeper, he says, here, take care of this fellow. And here's some money. You notice he gave the money to the innkeeper. He didn't give it to the rummy. Says, here's somebody, take care of him, and if it be any more, now here's how I know he's a traveling salesman. He says, I will repay you on my next trip. He'll be back through there. When I come by, I'll pay you, repay you for whatever you put out for him. He took care of the guy. He went that extra mile. And he paid him, he took the responsibility. That was the first AA call in history. Another favorite story of mine in a good book is the story of those two boys, the prodigal son. Here is a dandy rummy story. I don't know if it ever occurred to you. I know you've all heard the story of those two boys. They're Jewish boys, and they're working on this on their dad's farm. He has a big spread there, a lot of animals, sheep and cattle and what have you, and everything, big place. Well, in those days, you probably heard Dave talking about trying to ogle some dough out of his old man today. You know, he'd tell you about it and how unsuccessful he was. Well, in those days, It was the custom that when the old man died, the boys would inherit what's the estate. And these two boys are out working on this farm. And this one kid, he's the Al-Anon kid. He's going along. He's doing just what a good Al-Anon should be doing. He's minding his own business. But this other guy, let just guess about this fellow. He can't wait till the old man dies. He has to have his right now. So he keeps bugging the old man for his share of the loot. He wants it now, like Dave said. He wanted to spend it now. And he wanted his dough. And he just bugged the old man. The old man couldn't take it anymore. So he finally says, okay, take your share of it and be gone. So he gives him his share of the estate, and away goes his kid. So what does it say in the good book? It says he went into a far country. And what did he do then? He squandered his substance in riotous living. How about that? It's almost like he came to this town. He squandered his substance in riotous living. I don't know if you ever did that. Of course not. And a famine set in, and he's in this far country, and he's tapped out, he's broke, he don't have a dime. Nothing. And a famine sets in, and this kid's trying to get a job, and there's no work, there's no way he can get an income. You know what happened to that kid? Remember, he's a Jew. He got a job on a hog farm. This is great. And did he eat what the hogs were eating? No. He ate what the hogs left over. It says he ate of the husks of the hogs. Boy, that's getting down there. Okay? And finally, what does it say? He says he came to himself. And this is exactly what you and I had to do. We came to ourselves. And he says, my father has much. And here I am in this country and I starve. He says, I will arise and go to my father. Remember that? That's exactly what you and I had to do when we took this third step. I will arise and go to my father, and I will tell him I am unworthy. We're all unworthy. There's not a person in this hall here tonight that deserves what we have here, not one of us. By the grace of God, we were given this chance. Don't ever forget that. Not because we are anything great. By the grace of God, we were given this chance. This boy had the same thing. He says, I will arise. It means he got up off his duff and did something. He said, I will go to my father and tell him I'm unworthy. And he did this, and he started back to his home, these many miles. And what happened? His father saw him coming. It says there his father saw him coming afar off. And he ran to him, and he fell on his neck and kissed him. He says, my son who is dead is alive. Let us make merry. Put a ring on his finger, a robe on, and shoes on his feet. My son, who is dead, is alive. Great story of the forgiveness of God. The same thing that happened to us. When I came to this fellowship, I had no wardrobe. I'd sold whatever was saleable long since. I had one brown shoe and one black shoe. I did. I had a sweater. I didn't even own an overcoat. I had nothing, you know? I went to my father, who has much. Today I get all my needs taken care of. I have to work for him, as everyone does. But I've given that opportunity. So this father, he did everything for this son, who had blown the whole bundle, blown everything. But he come back and he forgave him. So this Al-Anon kid, he's out there in the field still working, like he should be. And he hears all this ruckus going on up at the house. Music playing, everything going on up there. So a servant comes by and says, hey, what's going on at the house? What's all the excitement up there? He says, didn't you know? He said, no what? He says, your brother came home. He says, oi, that no dirty, no good. So he beats it up the house. Now listen to this. He says, Pa, I've always been a good son to you. I've always done what I'm supposed to do. I've kept all your injunctions, and I worked. You never gave me a party. How do you like that? The old man had to straighten him out. It's a great rummy story. It's a great story of forgiveness, of acceptance, and a new beginning and a new life. It's a story of understanding of the father. It's a great rummy story. You can't tell me that kid that squandered his substance in riotous living was anything but a rummy. He couldn't get rid of it that fast. These stories meant something to me. When I came to this fellowship, we had to depend on these type of stories and the Bible for our survival, I should say. We didn't have this AA book. We didn't have this literature. We didn't have these nice facilities, these offices. We didn't have the nice press that we have. I could stand here for hours and tell you about things, how they were and what happened and how these things had to be overcome. I don't do this for a reason people might think that I say I did this and I did that. I was an agent performing a lot of things that God instructed me to do because I didn't have enough sense to come in out of the rain when I came here. No man lays around drunk for 4 or 5 years with the punishment that I gave myself can possibly have anything left up here that's really has much accountability to it. But I did a lot of things. I had to meet a lot of people and make a lot of connections with people who could be helpful to us. And I look back on the years ago and see that little old guy back there, and I wonder how it ever happened. It just doesn't seem real to me. It seems like a dream. But it happened. But it was not my doings. I was guided into these things and ordered into these things. I can tell you some of the weirdest things that happened. Really. I want to tell you one thing. This is something. I want to show you how God acts and does for us. When we got started in Cleveland, I went around and talked to a lot of ministers, talked to judges, I talked to social workers, people who were sources of rummies, and told them what they might do and how we could help them with their rummies that they come across and be working with. And I had a lot of resistance from some of these ministers. Some of them were okay. Some of them, they thought we were starting some new fandangled religion to compete with them or something. And we had to get to the Catholic Church. It's no use going to 101 different priests around. All you have to do is get to the bishop in the Catholic diocese, and if he sees things your way, he takes care of all the rest of that. And I wanted to see the bishop. I'm not of his faith. And I went down to his office and inquire, and you try to see the bishop of a Catholic diocese sometime, and you're going to have an experience, especially if you're not one of his flock, I guess, because they'd take me through a room here and a door here and another one, the next thing you're at my outside again. This wasn't working, and it's rather frustrating, but I determined I got to see this fellow. I didn't expect a lot of cooperation, but I didn't want them to be against this, at least. So finally the break happened. The good Lord is good. He came out of his office one day and was slippery, and he slipped on the ice and broke his leg. This is an act of God. I thought, now I am going to meet the bishop. I knew that he'd be in... They took him to Charity Hospital, which is a downtown Catholic hospital. I knew that he'd be laid up there for some time. And there'd be a lot of people in there first week or two sympathizing with him and telling how sorry they are and what can they do for him. Then after a couple of weeks, they forget it all and someone else is doing his work. So I waited my time. And by some devious inquiry of a couple of student nurses, I found out what room he was in. So I got the AA book under my arm and a copy of The Upper Room, which was published by the Methodist Church South. And I went down to call on the bishop. And I walked up and down in front of his room there, and I see him in there with his leg up in the air in traction. And he's reading a book, and sure enough, he's lonesome. I bust in on him and introduced myself, and he was happy to have company, really. And I told him what I was there for. I explained what we were trying to do. He says, well, that sounds like the Oxford movement to me. I says, well, it has been, but it isn't going to be here. We have broken away from the Oxford movement. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. And here, I have a book here, and if you would, I'd appreciate if you'd read it. He says, well, I'd like to read that book. So I gave him the copy of the book, and then I sprung this upper room on him. We had a daily reading that we all did, and this upper room was it. Everybody read it every day. So I handed him this, and I says, well, I suppose you might have something that's more appropriate for your folks. He says, no, that's all right. That won't hurt them. They can read it. But, he says, if you want something, I can get you some things. And he sent me bales of literature for our literature table. So this is the way we got answered the prayer and broke the poor guy's leg, but we got what we needed. This might have a lot of humor in it, but believe me, there are some remarkable things that happened in those days that I'm trying to get together and put in a book. And I hope someday, I'm so doggone lazy, I just don't get around to doing it. There are a lot of very interesting things that took place in the early days in the formation of this fellowship that ought to give people some inspiration, if not a few laughs once in a while. But it was a remarkable thing, and to be associated with it at that time is a rare experience. And I shall... Some of these things, they're nothing short of miraculous. They're miracles. I could write a whole book, really, I could, just on the miracles I've seen in AA. And I mean miracles, the things that never could happen, but they did. As I said before, every person here is a result of a miracle. We learn how to pray. As I mentioned, don't pray for sobriety. Someone did that for you long before you got here, and that was answered. But pray prayers of thanksgiving. Pray for other people. Pray for strength, guidance, and direction. That's all we have to pray for. It's a great life. It's a simple program. It's been great talking to you folks. I want to say a couple things before I close. Everything in this program came from the Sermon on the Mount and the Book of James. Our whole 12-step program, that's where it emanated from. So if anyone gives you a lot of talk about this religion and the spiritual part of AA, there's no spiritual part to it. It's all spiritual. It's not religion, it's a spiritual program. And it comes from the Sermon on the Mount, the sermon that Christ preached to his disciples. It comes from the book of James, the theme of which is faith without works is dead. Now, in the Bible, you can read the answers to everything. You know, slippers. I want to give you a little quotation from the good book on slippers. A person stays in AA and has the benefit of this for a long time, and he gets drunk. Why do you think it's so hard for him to come back? Well, obviously people say, well, he doesn't have that first pink cloud experience and that first excitement. That's very true. But there's something in Luke, the 11th chapter of Luke, about this. It talks about the unclean spirit, about when the unclean spirit goes out of a man, he walketh through dry places seeking rest, and finding none, he saith, I will return unto my house where I came out. That's what this evil spirit's talking about. And when he cometh, he findeth it swept and garnished. It's all cleaned up. Wonderful. Then goeth he and taketh with him seven other spirits, more wicked than himself. And they enter in, and the last estate of that man is worse than the first. That's a lesson for people who get off of this program through their own neglect and selfishness. They should read that. This is the answer to that. There's always reasons, but here's an answer. Everything we have come out of that good book. Now then, I want to close reading something from my sponsor. This is the last talk Doc Smith ever made. He was dying when he made this talk. Made this talk at a group in Cleveland at a big meeting. I guess it was what they'd call the first conference they ever had. So on Sunday, July 30th, 1950, he died shortly after this. They took him there, and he made this short talk. He says, my good friends in AA and of AA, I feel I would be very remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to welcome you here to Cleveland, not only to this meeting, but those that have already transpired. I hope very much that the presence of so many people and the words that you have heard will prove an inspiration to you. Not only to you, but may you be able to impart that inspiration to the boys and girls back home who were not fortunate enough to be able to come. In other words, we hope that your visit here has been both enjoyable and profitable. I get a big thrill out of looking over the vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing that I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. Get that? If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months. And my strength hasn't returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is. So let's bear these 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member, the tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to explain things to us and to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts in our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us, to our less fortunate brothers. Thank you very much. God bless you all.